Quaker.com podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 25th, 2012. This is podcast number 136. There have been some items in the news lately, and I don't actually have the kind of notes that I would like to have had for an intelligent discussion of them. But to kind of give you an overview, and if you've been paying attention to the news, you probably have seen some reference to this. Basically, quite a few states have started either enacting or reiterating or discussing the possibility of reenacting the so-called Castle Doctrine laws. Now, and I can't remember all the states that, what activity is taking place in different states. I know that recently, I believe it was Indiana, that reinforced their castle doctrine by actually saying that homeowners essentially could defend their home even to illegal searches by the police, even to the point of shooting police that are attempting to enter their home without the proper warrants and so forth. And other states, I believe either Michigan or Minnesota, one or the other, recently their Supreme Court of that state made a decision reinforcing the state's castle doctrine. And there, this whole mess down in Florida with the kid that was shot and the guy that was the neighborhood watch person. That all wraps around some of the aspects of the Castle Doctrine. And at times they'll throw, negative connotations on the Castle Doctrine to try to, line it up with things like the go ahead, make my day phrases and things like this to try to make it as, sound as gun crazy as possible. But I thought that it would be a good thing to just kind of touch the Castle Doctrine, mention what it really is, what it's supposed to be, what it was traditionally, and how that relates to the discussion today and to the so-called, laws that deal with it now. The first time, I believe, and I could be wrong on this, but the first time I think that the actual phrase Castle Doctrine was used, and I'm not even sure if he called it Castle Doctrine or if he just referred to a home being a castle, but that would be by Edward Coke, the law authority from ancient England from Middle Ages. In 1628, and I do have a little bit of notes here, but in 1628 he wrote a thing called The Institutes of the Laws of England. And what he was really doing, he was not making law, he was not writing law, all he was doing was putting in order laws that already existed, that were already traditional laws in England, already well-established, recognized laws in England. Even if no one had ever written them down, England was functioning under a whole series of laws that were understood among the people, even without specifically writing them down. So that what he was doing then was writing them down in a form that attorneys and judges and so forth that were trying to learn about law could actually refer to and get an idea of what the statements were. So this is where we first get this idea that a person's home is their castle. Well, no, I said that wrong. That's not where we first get the idea. The idea was already well established and well accepted. All Edward Coke did was essentially put it in writing for scholars and so forth to have a record of it. But it already predated all English, all written English law. The idea, and it's important that we really get the concept and not technicalities of the words or how the words are intended or how the words are used today or whatever. It's really important to understand what the intention of the law was, and it was very clear. The intention was very clear. If you own property, you own that property, and you can determine who can come on that property. You can determine whether or not they have the authority to come in and arrest you, or whether they have the authority to come in and search or do anything else, arrest somebody else that they're looking for that happens to be on your property. Keep in mind, there were incidents where kings of England would besiege private castles and fight against individual people attempting to get them out of their home for one reason or another, and the king would have to literally wait on the outside and couldn't go in. Because the English tradition was, and English law, recognized English law was, that if you own the property, you own the property. The king didn't own that property. You own that property. And so even if the king was going to come on your property, he needed the proper permissions. So this came to us in this sense through Old England and down into the colonies, and was well recognized in the after the War of Independence, and was reiterated in early documentation in the young United States. However, like all other good traditional laws that have passed to us from the ancients, this has been watered down over the years. So this hint of a shell of the castle doctrine that we see bantied around in the news media nowadays and that legislators are arguing over and so forth, that's just a shell of what used to be. As I looked around, I found one website that claimed to list state by state whether or not there was a castle doctrine and what the technicalities of it were and so forth. And the website completely failed to address the question about whether or not law enforcement were included in that. And the areas that were covered by both that website and other websites that I visited clearly made the exception that, well, this doesn't apply to authorities, of course. Well, it used to. It used to apply to authorities. And this is why the colonists were so upset when they were forced to quarter military, or when they were forced to take in, representatives of the governor or representatives of the king into their home or into their buildings and feed them and tolerate them. This is the very thing that upset the colonists, was that they understood that their home was their castle, and they understood this so-called castle doctrine, and they understood that their rights as English people were being violated. That's one of the intolerable acts that they were so upset about. And yet, as time passes by and the United States gets further and further away from its roots, we begin to make excuses as to why the ancient laws that used to work for so long have to be abandoned now. And when it really boils down, all of these things like this, it comes down to the point of where really it's just an excuse for the state to have more authority and the individual to have less. Whether we're talking about the right to protect yourself and bear arms. Now, keep in mind, when long before the Constitution was written and the so-called Second Amendment, the holy Second Amendment that so many people bow before, long before that was written, it was well understood that a free person, any free person had the right to protect themselves, and any free person had the right to not only carry concealed weapons where nobody can see them, and not only carry them out in the open where they can readily be observed, but to carry them however you want. A free person should be able to arm themselves in any way they want and move about freely in any way they want, as long as they're not interacting with using aggression upon other people. And that was the ancient stand. That's the way it had always been. And then we start to write these things down, whether it be Edward Coke doing it or whether it would be in the form of the Constitution with people attempting to write these things down and give them a perimeter that cuts off their authority. So, and what I mean by that is, so you write things down. You say, okay, so here's the Second Amendment, and you write it all down. And then lawyers begin to pick it apart and say, well, does it really mean this or does it mean that? And they don't go with the actual intent. They go with technicalities of the wording of it. And therefore, it falls apart. So the very act of Edward Coke writing down the Castle Doctrine was the beginning of the deterioration of the Castle Doctrine. And the very act of writing down the Second Amendment was the beginning in the United States of the tearing down and the deterioration of the right to protect oneself. And nowadays, we've gotten to the point of where some states are so weak on this area that you are required by law to make every effort to try to escape prior to using violence to protect yourself. And in some situations, you have to, if you actually do commit violence to protect yourself, you have to prove that you really believed you were about to be killed. Well, this is nonsense. This is in no way... does that hold up to any kind of historical scrutiny at all? This is all something new that the state has dumped upon us and we've accepted because we've forgotten. We've forgotten the lessons of history and we've forgotten what our ancestors knew. And instead, we've entrusted ourselves to the state to make these laws and the state to protect us and to do all these things for us so that we are not complete people. We no longer have the right to actually arm ourselves and protect ourselves in the way that traditionally free people have been able to do. And, of course, the reason why is because we're not free. We're simply not free. Now, when you hear about, like, not long ago, I believe it was Indiana? I believe it was Indiana that the Supreme Court of that state actually said that, yes, you can shoot a police officer if they're entering your home forcibly without the proper paperwork, without the, you know, all the right things and all this kind of thing. And so many people were so excited. They said, yes, finally the Castle Doctrine is being restored and finally self-protection and the right of, you know, a right of private property and so forth is being respected. But no, what they're really just doing is, you know, it's what the state has always done. The state will lurch forward and take a mile, and then when you show enough people getting enough upset about it to where the state's bluff is called, then the state will back down. But if the state took a mile, the state will never back down a mile. The state will always back down less than what it took. And then it'll just wait, and it'll wait. And when the opportunity arises, it takes another mile. And then you have to fight it back a half a mile or whatever. And then it'll accept that temporary setback. But it will never go back to where it was before. You can never get the state to shrink back. This is why this is in regards to authority, in regards to power, in regards to size and scope. It's all the same. You will never get the government back to a certain point where it was tolerable. First off, the government was never tolerable. But the idea that you can get it to shrink back some way, it's just never worked. It will always move forward towards oppression more than it ever moves backwards towards allowing you liberty. In the case of this Castle Doctrine, a couple of state Supreme Courts judge somewhat in favor of the Castle Doctrine, and some of your rights remain intact and not trampled on, some, but not really. After all, if they have a little piece of paper signed by somebody you never met, then all that goes out the window and they can come barging in anyway. So, you know, in a sense, you're forcing them to have a little piece of paper. Well, that's a little bit of a victory, but it's not really, because you know, now they just get a piece of paper and storm on in anyway, and they'll come in with their SWAT team or whatever, and there's very little you can do about it, and to fight them is a form of suicide. So, really, what have you gained? Now, then, let's just assume you do feel better about everything because they have decided for the Castle Doctrine on a couple of occasions. So you're starting to feel better about yourself, and you're like, hey, we might have a chance. But then the Department of Homeland Security raids a flea market under the guise of pirating laws, and they're ripping through a flea market looking for knockoff cosmetics and unlicensed NASCAR hats. Well, I'm certainly glad we have Homeland Security to save us from the evil, you know, pirate lipstick and knockoff NASCAR hats. I don't know where we'd be if it weren't for Department of Homeland Security saving us from these horrible terrorists that sell bad perfume and cheap hats, you know. And then, again, at the same time, we're hearing about heirloom pigs being slaughtered and the government actually attacking farmers, forcing them to kill their own pigs, bringing armed people onto farms, killing the pigs just for the purpose of wiping out the herds because it's not an approved breed of pig. And these people are making their living on these heirloom pig varieties. And the government just decides, nope, we're going to sign a piece of paper here. Some politician that knows absolutely nothing about livestock or swine or pig raising, some bureaucrat that is not even elected, is going to make a decision, and some politician is going to sign off on it. And just like that, your heirloom pigs that you have spent so much money raising and so much money to make sure that you have all the paperwork with them and that their heritage is all documented, and you're in the process of making money on these heirloom pigs, and the government just comes in, forces you to destroy all your pigs, literally goes around shooting baby pigs on your farm, and there's not a thing you can do about it. Or what's going on still with the Amish, with the milk Nazis raiding the Amish farms? This stuff is happening, and yet we're told, well, this is great. The Castle Doctrine is being upheld in these states. Well, you know, it's I don't know. What can I compare that to? It's like if I went to a restaurant and sat down, at a table in a nice restaurant, and the waiter is starting to serve me some really good high-end food, and right in the middle of serving this really nice high-end food, he punches me in the face. And I'm supposed to just sit here and take the punch in the face because, hey, isn't this a nice steak? But aren't you enjoying your steak? Is it cooked exactly like you would like? Is the potato okay? Is the side item exactly what you wanted? Wonderful. Bang, punch in the face again. Well, that's kind of what's happening. You know, we're offered these lovely things like, oh, look, you still have some freedom on the internet. Oh, look, you can still drive around to a certain extent. Oh, look, we're going to start to pass some laws honoring the aspects of the Castle Doctrine. And yet, at the same time, we'll just randomly arrest you anytime we want. If under the guise that you're associated with a terrorist organization some way, we can lock you away indefinitely and kill you if the government so decides without a trial or any kind of hearing and no attorney whatsoever is consulted. We can do all those things. We can raid your farm. We can take your milk. We can confiscate your cheese. We can shoot your pigs. We can come into your house with nothing more than a slip of paper. And the first thing is they breach the door. They hear a dog barking. They immediately shoot the dog because that's standard operating procedure for these SWAT raids. They can do all those things. And we're supposed to sit back and say, oh, look, ignore all those bad things. Ignore all those punches in the face. We have the Castle Doctrine. This local state Supreme Court has made a decision that they're going to back up the Castle Doctrine. So everything's fine. Yeah, but, you know, if the IRS makes a glitch, has a problem, makes a mistake of some kind, and decides that you owe them back taxes, they can yank your passport and not leave you out, not let you out of the country. And yet, oh, but we're supposed to feel better because, see, this is what the state does. This is what the state has always done. It always pushes ahead to the point of where you can no longer tolerate the state's existence. And when it gets to that point, it pulls back a little. Until you get comfortable with it being in that position, then it'll push forward again all the way to the point of where you're ready for revolution, and then it will pull back. Now, and this is a good time for me to point out, this is exactly my problem with all the Ron Paul followers. Your best case scenario is that you're going to bring Ron Paul into the government and he's going to cause government to pull back. Well, how far is he going to pull it back exactly? What really can he do? And some of the more radical followers will say, well, he can eliminate all these cabinet-level positions. He can eliminate Homeland Security. He can eliminate the Education Department. He can do this, that, and the other thing. He can do all those things, yes. And what's he done when he does those things? He's just made a government that is far more efficient and just as evil, because it still relies on aggression and theft. And then Ron Paul, even if he made it to the presidency, even if he made a full 4 years, even if he was reelected and did an additional 4 years and had 8 years in the presidency and he did all the things you hope that he does, what has he actually done? What he has actually done is he has allowed the state to become far more efficient and far better at what it does. And what is it that the state really does? It steals, it lies, it kills. That's what the state does. The state doesn't provide you anything. People provide services. And whether those services are paid for by the state through aggression and theft, or whether they're paid for through voluntary means, if there's a need for something, if there's a need for roads, if there's a need for ambulance service, if there's a need for fire service, for police services, if there's a need for those, then people will be inspired to fill that need. But when you insert the aggression of government, you still have the need, you still have people providing the need. But all you've done is added theft and aggression, and then you've added a level of bureaucracy that is going to cost the whole system more than otherwise. The other day I put a link to a thing on Facebook. It was a quote from, well, let me interrupt. You're probably hearing in the background, I should have mentioned this when I very first started, but I got wrapped up in a rant and kind of got carried away. We have a lot of background noise. You're hearing trucks and things. There's a lot of construction going on outside, so sorry about that. I should have mentioned it earlier. Anyway, on my Facebook page, I put a link to a quote by Thomas Sowell. And I think I probably messed up his name, but the quote goes like this. It says, "It is amazing that people who think we cannot afford to pay for doctors, hospitals, and medication somehow think that we can afford to pay for doctors, hospitals, medication, and a government bureaucracy to administer it." And it really, if you think about it, there's so many people that understand that by socializing medicine, all you're doing is taking the process that people already want, you know, the medical industry, and then you're adding a layer of bureaucracy and aggression to it. That's all you're doing when you socialize medicine. So that concept is very easy for a lot of people to recognize and understand. You're not making medicine more available by socializing it. You're actually making it less available. You're not improving the quality. You're making it less improved. You're causing it to cost more and to be less efficient than it was. And you're doing that because you're adding aggression and you're adding a bureaucracy to what would otherwise be a service that the market has provided throughout time. And a lot of people can see that, but they can't see the other half of it. So I added this to it. I said, if you agree with the good doctor, take the next logical step and apply the principle to something that the government supplies for you. Ask yourself what you absolutely have to have government to provide for you. Then apply the principle that you've already agreed that's true. So then, for instance, I made this example. People who think that we cannot or will not pay for roads, police, and security somehow think that we can pay for roads, police, and security with government bureaucracies to administer them. So all we're talking about is services that people, that if people want them, if people want roads, then that desire will inspire some people to build roads, because if someone wants it, they'll be willing to trade something for it. So that means there's a market for it. And however that market works itself out, the details are not important. The fact is, if there's a desire for something, if there's a need for something, the market will fill it. And if there's a state involved, the market still fills the need. The state didn't fill the need. The market filled the need. All the state did was bring in government, is the state being the belief that we actually need government. The state then just brings in government, and government adds levels of bureaucracy and aggression, and it costs way more than it would otherwise cost, and it's based on aggression instead of being based on voluntarism. So the government didn't provide you for anything. Your faith in the state, all that did was it made the product or service more expensive than normal and forced it rather than having the market do it naturally. And a lot of people can understand this and can see it when we're talking about, like, socialized medicine. They can understand why socialized medicine is bad. Or if we applied it to something else, let's say we're talking about groceries. Well, food is more important than health care. Certainly, you know, everybody needs food. Not everybody needs health care. So in the scale of importance, food is more important than health care. And yet we don't argue for socialized food, although we're moving towards it at a blinding pace. But so let's think about socialized food. Can we say, well, how would we get food if it weren't for the government? If the government didn't use aggression to take taxes from people to buy food, how would we get food? Well, that's kind of silly, considering you can just go to the grocery store and buy food. But if the principle applies to one thing, it applies to something else. So we understand how it works with food. We don't need the government to steal from us, to take that money, to set up a bureaucracy, and then inspire the market to supply food. We don't need that. It's unnecessary. People want food. People are willing to work labor, come up with money, and then use that money to buy food. So we have food. And yet, even though we can see how this principle works with food, and we can see how it works with health care, we can't see how it would work with roads. Or we can't see how it could possibly work with a fire department. Or we can't see how it could possibly work with police. And the old thing, whenever you start to corner a statist on these topics, the statist will always fall back to a false dichotomy. They'll try to say, well, sure, we could have volunteer fire departments, but how good would that work? What we need is professionals. Well, you just created, no, I'm not saying volunteer. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have professionals. I'm saying the market will provide that. And the market will provide it without layers of bureaucracy that swallow up massive amounts of tax money but don't produce anything. Anyway, so let me see if I can get back to my notes over here. Well, or I could check the time and see how... it's a good thing I checked the time. We have to put in a commercial. So I'm going to break for a commercial. And I want to mention we're in the process of negotiating with a new sponsor to go with the other two sponsors. So that might even mean shorter commercials but the same amount of time. So I'm not sure how it'll work out. We're going to work on the details on it real soon, and then you'll find out. But for right now, stick with me through the commercial. It's 2 minutes long. It's not that long. And I'll be right back on the other side. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, and I'm back. Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. Now, I was talking there about not being fooled when, you know, when the aggression of the state backs down a little bit and government seems to shrink a little bit in one area. And we have this new, you know, the state's voted in something supporting the Castle Doctrine, or the state Supreme Court has made a decision supporting the Castle Doctrine or whatever. Don't be fooled by these concessions, because the state will never give up as much as it takes. So if it's willing to give up a little bit of freedom back to you, it's because it figured out a way to take 10 times more freedom than some other way. And it's probably doing it in a way that you're not thinking of or you're not noticing at this particular time. It's kind of like, it's the old smoke and mirrors trick. If they can keep you distracted, if they can keep you noticing the beautiful assistant in her scantily clad outfit, if they can get you looking in that direction, or if they can move their hand in such a way that it draws your attention away from the other hand while they actually do the activity, then you don't notice when you've been had. You know, it's the three card Monty where they move their hands and they shuffle around, and you can't actually ever know which card is which, or which walnut shell has the pea underneath it, because none of them have it, because it's all a trick, it's all sleight of hand. You can't win at it. They cheat. They always do. They always have. And that's how the state works. They give you a distraction. They hand you a pacifier. It's like, it very much like with a small child. You give that child a pacifier, and it sucks and it sucks on its pacifier, and it's busy doing stuff. It's totally engulfed in trying to get something out of that pacifier, and it never notices that the pacifier produces nothing for it. The pacifier brings it absolutely no substances coming out of the pacifier. It provides nothing, and yet the child is content as long as he feels like he's doing something. And that's what the state does to us. It gives us levels and levels of activity that we can be involved in, you know, whether it's circuses and bread, you know, is the old thing where you know, you can always go down and watch the free circuses and watch the bears dance, and you can see these things and they keep your mind occupied. You can watch TV, you can hear the news, you can watch the lively debates between the talking heads, and all the time you feel like you're doing something, all the time you feel like, yeah, we're moving, we're progress, people are hearing about this, people are understanding about it, but they're not. All they're doing is seeing the shell move around on the table. All they're doing is sucking on a pacifier. they're not really ever changing the progress that the state is making, taking us deeper and deeper towards complete slavery. Because all those things are a distraction. They're all just meant to keep us busy. Oh, but we're voting now. Yeah, we're going to get out there and vote. We're going to all get together and form a committee, and I'm going to get involved, and I'm going to get elected to become a delegate to this assembly, or a delegate to this party, or whatever. And you're busy doing all these things, and you really, really feel like you're doing something. But what you're actually doing is just hugging your security blanket and sucking on your pacifier. You're not actually getting any sustenance from it. It's not producing anything of any value. And that's what the state does. Now, all the things that we imagine that government does for us, that we're convinced are absolutely critical things that we have to have, the market would provide all those things. The market is providing them now. When you go to, if you think, well, it's important that we have safety on our highways, and in doing that, we have to know that people driving in cars can at least know how to drive the car. So we have a department or a bureau of motor vehicles that makes sure that each driver is licensed. Well, don't you think that that same desire would exist if there were no state? Wouldn't there still be a desire to know that all the other drivers around you are qualified drivers? Isn't there a market for that today? And doesn't the market provide that today? You know, back in the days of Adolf Hitler, there was a car company in Germany, and Adolf Hitler wanted a small, inexpensive vehicle that the German people could drive around. And so he collaborated with this car company, with a gentleman named Porsche, and they developed a people's car, or Volkswagen. And this Volkswagen was a collaboration of the government and this company. It was not something that the market was demanding. It was something that that Hitler and his administration decided was through their central planning, because this is what socialism does. They decided that it was a good thing for the people to have. Now, would the market have ever produced that good on its own? It's debatable. At some point in time, there was a desire for the Volkswagen. It wasn't in the 30s. It wasn't really up until well into the 50s and early 60s until a real market developed for the Volkswagen. And then the market supplied that need with vigor. But when the state was pushing the production of the Volkswagen, when Adolf Hitler was pushing the production of the Volkswagen, really, it was still the market. The market was doing this. It was just that the market was being influenced by the central planners within Adolf Hitler's administration. So the market is the real one that does this. The market is the real one that says, okay, if there's a desire to have people licensed before they get out on the highway to drive, if the market desires that, then the market provides that. The existence of government in that mix is just like the existence of government in healthcare. All it does is add layers of bureaucracy, forces it to cost more, and takes away from its efficiency. Because that's what government does. That's all government ever does. So we don't have licensing because the government is evil and the government makes us have licensing. We have licensing of auto, of vehicles and drivers and all these things, because the market wants it. The fact that the government is involved in it and uses its force just makes it a horrible mess. And this is the same with anything else. Why do we have roads? We have roads because there's a market for roads. And then the government gets involved with layers of bureaucracy, taking out massive loans with sweetheart deals to specific contractors who stretch the construction out for years rather than getting the job done. The background noise that I mentioned earlier right here at my house today in Springboro, Ohio. Let me just give a little idea of what happened there. Several years back, this has probably been 6 or 7 years ago, on the east side of the housing area that I live in. I live in a subdivision, and on the east side of this subdivision, there was a new industrial park that was being put in, and there was a lot of new buildings that were being put up and new construction and so forth. Now, rather than route all the construction equipment, which they had to move in, it seemed like 1,000 truckloads of dirt in order to build up this area to support the new construction. Rather than having all these huge dump trucks full of dirt drive through the main part of town and disrupt traffic, because the town of Springboro has a horrible road system as it is, and all the traffic is forced through one north and south and one east and west road. So rather than have all of this truck traffic go through an already overcrowded main city streets, the city decided to force the contractors who were building in this industrial park, they decided to force them to go through the neighborhood that I live in with all their heavy dump trucks loaded down with dirt. Now, when this first took place, keep in mind, I have, my dad used to own a construction company, and I came into the workforce at the age of 13 working in construction. And plus, with the certain engineering background that I have and what I picked up from my dad and so forth, and the years in different industries, I have a pretty good engineering mind. So, and I know how roads are built. I know how road beds are laid down. I know how, water lines and sewer lines and all the underground utilities go in. I've been in all that business enough to know how all that stuff works. So when the city rerouted all these big, heavy dump trucks through the middle of this little neighborhood, I looked at that and I thought, And I told my family and I told friends, anybody else that would listen, this is a horrible idea. This is a horrible idea to send all these heavy trucks through this neighborhood. Not only is it not safe because you have trucks driving way too fast with way too much weight through twisty neighborhood streets, and not only is it unsafe, but it's really stupid because these streets are not designed to handle that kind of weight. When you build a roadbed like the state highway that cuts through the middle of Springboro, the middle of the town that I live in, when you build a roadbed for that, they design it from the very beginning realizing that it's going to have a lot of heavy traffic on it. So from the very first parts of the roadbed, they use a size of a gravel, and then they as they build the roadbed up, they change the size of that gravel, and they go so many inches of this kind of gravel and so many inches of that kind of gravel, and then they lay down concrete, and then they lay down reinforcement, and then they put more concrete, and they build up the roadbed in such a way that it can handle this super heavy traffic like these big dump trucks. But when they build residential streets, they don't do that. They don't build up the roadbed like that. And the residential streets in the neighborhood like the one I'm in, this was built in the late 60s. And basically what they did, they just kind of came in with road graders and graded it all out the way that they wanted it to look. And then they lay down a light layer of gravel, and then they lay down the roads. Then they cut in all the main water lines and all the main sewer lines, and then they repair that back out and lay the final road on top of that, the final pavement on top of that. And it's never intended to handle any heavyweight trucks at all. As a matter of fact, big highway trucks are not supposed to come into neighborhoods like this other than for a delivery of some kind, and that's strictly on a temporary, not on a regular basis. So the roads are just not designed to handle that kind of weight. So these years ago, when they started doing this, when the city forced all these contractors to use a longer route through this neighborhood, driving slow, having to deal with neighborhood turns and twists and traffic and everything, and I'm watching the roadbed as these trucks are going by, and you could literally feel and see the roadbed flex as these huge trucks go by. And I'm telling people, They're in the process of destroying the sewer lines, and they're destroying the water lines underneath that road. And it's going to cost them dearly. This, by rerouting all these trucks through this neighborhood, they're going to have to come in here and dig up all these water lines and replace all this stuff. And that was, like I say, years ago. Now, the very next winter after that happened, the city began having leaks in their water line on the same streets that they rerouted all those heavy trucks through. And every year since then, we've had multiple leaks in the main water line up and down through this whole track right where all those trucks drove. And so now that comes to today, and the construction that you hear in the background behind me is the city coming through and digging up the middle of the roadbed, and they're putting in a brand new water main, and they're having to do that because the old water main is costing them, because they have to repair it several times a year, because all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this water main that's been stable for 40 years, the water main's been stable. And now it's leaking like a sieve, and it's, you know, not only the water line, we had a gas main break about a half a block away from us last year, and we had raw gas, well, it's not raw, it's treated, but by that, I mean, it has a scent added to it, but the main gas line for the supplies on the street broke down the street, and you could smell it all over the neighborhood. And they had to come in an emergency and shut the thing down and try to get to it and isolate it. And, you know, this is all because somebody in the city decided to reroute all that traffic through a neighborhood instead. Now, and the reason I'm bringing that up is because this is what government does. The market would provide all these things for us. The market is providing all these things for us. These people that drive up and down in the streets and these construction trucks that are doing all these things, they're all aspects of the market. The difference is the market now is burdened by having to support the government with all the aggression of the state and the theft that goes with it. And if there were no state, and if we didn't believe in the state, and the government was voluntary and worked for the market, as a part of the market, rather than trying to dominate the market, then we would still have all these things. We would have everything that people want. If they want it now, they would want it if there was no government. And if they don't want it under no government, then they probably don't want it now. And that would be the difference. Now, I got way off the topic there, but I wanted to emphasize that these things that the market provides for us, the market is providing them, not the state. We would have them with or without the state. It's just that when you add the burden of government upon it, then you have these bureaucracies that you have to deal with, and you have aggression, you have theft, you have all the corruption that comes with a government, all because people believe in a state. Now, I want to quote Voltaire here. He said, "In general, the art of government consists in taking as much money as possible from one party of the citizens to give to another." And keep in mind, when Voltaire wrote this, there was no welfare class. There was no government giveaway programs for all the poor people, and there was no government giveaway programs for all these different things. So he's not talking about taking wealth away from the working class and giving it to the poor. He's not talking about wealth redistribution through any kind of social programs that help people. He's strictly talking about stealing from working people and giving to the political class of people. That's what he's talking about. And that's exactly what's going on now. That's what was going on then. The reason I say that's what he was talking about is because there were no social giveaway programs back then. All that stuff came in later when Bismarck introduced it in Germany as a means of controlling the population by giving them, you know, these different free giveaway government programs and making them reliant upon the state. That was a scheme of Bismarck's, and that was, long after Voltaire was dead. So Voltaire was not talking about welfare programs or government handouts or any of those things like that. When he said The art of government consists of making in taking as much money as possible from one party of the citizens and giving it to the other. He's talking about the looting of the working people and giving that money to the political class. That's what he was talking about. And so when you really think about it, you know, you'll hear libertarians and you'll hear anarchists and so forth talking about whether there is or is not a class division and whether there is or not class warfare and all these things. Really, 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 there are two classes of people. Those who live off the government and those who support the government. And that's really all there is. What Franz Oppenheimer called the political means and the economic means. There are those of us who create wealth, and there are those who destroy wealth or consume wealth. And that's really all there is. Now, like I was saying, there's these services like police and firefighters and all the things that we think of government providing. But really, the market is providing those. The government is only interfering in the process, just like with the healthcare thing. Now, let's see where we're at on time. Well, we're doing pretty good. I might have time to mention the next thing that I had in mind. I wanted to talk about, in the U.S., the desire to move out west, the process that took place all throughout the 1800s where people would abandon the place where they had lived for one or more generations, sometimes many generations, and head up and try to move out west into an unknown land and for unknown reasons. And of course, one of the things we always think of when we think about the movement west is the gold rushes and the silver rushes and the copper rushes. There was a lead rush and all this. We think of these mineral rushes that took place where there was a great incentive to move west and get rich quick in some kind of thing. But the vast majority of people who moved west in the 1800s were not moving west because of gold rushes. They were moving west to try to escape the growing dominance of the state in the east. As government influence grew and grew, and local county entities began springing up, and county taxes began piling upon people, this inspired people to get up and move west where these things hadn't been formulated yet. And it was actually attempting to escape the state. That was the main motivator for these settlers. Now, and if you're not sure about this, try this as an experiment. Now, not everybody can do this, especially not if you're a listener in Poland or if you're a listener in England or even if you're a listener in, you know, Alaska or Canada or even the west coast of the United States. This is not really feasible, but for anyone who can do this, here's a little experiment. You get in a car and you start driving across eastern Kentucky. And just drive, stay mostly on the main roads, that's safer anyway, but drive across eastern Kentucky in a north-south direction primarily is more handy. And look at the landscape, look at the amount of homes, look at the, out in the country, there's not really a lot of big cities in eastern Kentucky anyway, but drive through there, and then drive up north and you get somewhere around, say, Huntington, West Virginia, or Greenup, Kentucky, or Portsmouth, Ohio, somewhere in that range, cross the rivers and go into southeastern Ohio, and drive up southeastern Ohio towards Columbus, Ohio. Now, as you do this, what you're going to find, there are a few scattered cities in that area, but mostly what you're going to find is a population that has grown slightly since the 1800s, but not a lot. It's near the same populations that it was in the 1800s. And in the 1800s, and there's a lot of free space. As you drive through that area, there's a lot of free space. And yet in the 1800s, people were fleeing that area as fast as they can. They would literally burn their house down to collect the nails out of their house because the nails were valuable. And the house is just built out of wood. There's more wood everywhere. So they would burn their cabin down, burn their house down, to collect the nails and hinges and other metal parts out of it, pile those all into a barrel, and then head west, specifically so that they could get away from the growing state. And they, and at the time, in the early 1800s, they would move to places like Missouri or Arkansas. A lot of people fled Appalachia and moved to Arkansas because, in many ways, Arkansas and southern Missouri was very similar to Appalachia, except in the early 1800s, there was no state in Arkansas and southern Missouri. And so a lot of Appalachian people took advantage of that and fled the growing menace of the state in Appalachia and made their way into Arkansas. And you can see this today in family names. If you look around at cemeteries, I realize this is going to sound a little freakish maybe, but I really enjoy old cemeteries. I think they're really cool. And if you go in Appalachia and drive around and walk around through some of the old cemeteries and look at the names, the family names in the cemeteries, and then you go to Arkansas or southern Missouri and you do the same, you're going to find a lot of the same family names, a lot of those same Scotch-Irish, Ulster Scott family names. And the reason why is because, literally, because they were attempting to get away from the growing state as it invaded Appalachia. And then as the 1800s burned on, and as we get closer to the middle of the 1800s, places like Arkansas and Missouri started to, it wasn't a population problem. There's all kinds of room even today in Arkansas and Missouri. You go there and drive around. Get off the main road, but don't get too far off the main road, but get off the main road in southern Missouri and drive around. There's all kinds of empty space. And yet, the state was moving in on people, and it forced them to move even further west. And they would move into Colorado. They moved into Oregon, into the Oregon Territory. They moved into Northern California. They moved into, you know, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, anywhere they could to move away from the state. Now, I realize that you're not going to get that in, you know, textbooks in public schools. But if you think it through and you really take a look at the spread of the state, and the spread of the state exactly followed the migration, really, of people attempting to get away from the state. As people moved away, they wanted to get away from the state, but the myth of the state held, they were wanting to get away from the government, I should say. They're wanting to get away from the government, but they couldn't let go of the myth of the state. And so it wouldn't be long before they start setting back up the government where they've moved to. And it didn't immediately become the oppressive nature that they, you know, that they were accustomed to in the East. But eventually it got there because not because they wanted the oppression, but because you can't have the government. If you believe in a state, you can't have the government without the oppression of the state. You have to reject the myth of the state first, and then you can form voluntary governments, and they'll last. Now, I wanted to touch one other thing before we're getting right at the end of the podcast. I wanted to touch one other thing before I run out of time. I just stumbled upon this, that if you Google the words Zero Aggression Principle Podcast, Zero Aggression Principle Podcast, those four words, take a look for yourself, just out of curiosity. I want to get you to do that and see what the first few entries are. I was really thrilled that badquaker.com is getting the kind of Google response that we're getting from something that is so central to what we want the topic at badquaker.com to be. Okay, so I appreciate you listening to the podcast. I appreciate, you know, we're getting now to where we're past our whole first year of doing the podcast, and I certainly appreciate the listeners and the emails that we get. It's been a while since I mentioned my email address is ben at badquaker.com, And feel free to email me. I get quite a few emails every week, and I try to answer as many of them as I can. I think I answer all. Sometimes one might slip through, but drop me an email, and I'll probably answer you. And as always, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks. Goodbye.